Vice Committee Chair Rita Athus.
Here.
Trustee Dennis Barsima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero. Trustee James Innes.
Here.
Trustee Leland Strum.
Here.
Committee Chair Eric Wasowitz.
Here.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Here.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry, would you please confirm that appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Mr. Chair, you have a quorum present and appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So moved, Gales.
Second, Athus.
We have a motion and we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor of approving the agenda signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of our prior meeting?
So made, Strum.
Second, Innes.
We have a motion and we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor of accepting the minutes from our prior meeting signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Chair comments. I'm really excited about the new partnership with Fermilab that has recently been announced, which is the launching of the Masters of Science in Physics with a specialization in quantum science and technology. This is truly the new frontier. We talk a lot about AI, but I think quantum is definitely the next leap. Reminds me of when Satya Nadella was named the CEO of Microsoft. I was at a business get together in the city, and one of us asked him what he thought about quantum computing, and he paused and said, "You know what? I really don't understand quantum computing, and but I'll get to that." And it's pretty out there. So this is the future, and there's one thing I know that we'll leapfrog artificial intelligence into the quantum area. So congrats to everyone here, President Freeman, Vice President Makarski, and all of your teams. That's great stuff. I want to welcome any university advisory committee representatives present today. Do you have any comments?
Just a brief comment. So we'll be hearing in a little bit from Dr. Subramoney on community engaged research that he has been a part of and leading. But ahead of that, I want to lay some groundwork just so you know what's happening on our campus. So related to this sort of work, to make sure that it's rewarded in the core incentive structure for our faculty so that it's elevated and permeates across our institution for our students, for our faculty, and for our staff. About 2 years ago, the faculty updated the bylaws governing the tenure and promotion system to be inclusive of community engaged research of the type that Dr. Subramoney will be talking about. And that brings it into the center of our key structures for faculty on campus, and it's seen as to try to make sure and ensure that it's seen as valid and valued here at NIU. So we are in the process of taking that from the university policy level and taking it down into our colleges and our academic units to make sure that all of our documents consider the inclusion of community engaged work as possible ways for faculty to demonstrate their excellence, their impact on students, on NIU, and the broader community. And this is just an excellent example of that type of work that we see as central to our core mission, vision, and values as an institution. And so we are working to change the core incentive structure for faculty to enable this type of work to be rewarded, incentivized, and elevated. So just wanted to give that background information. So thank you.
All right, thank you. And that's going to be a really good lead into our presentation here later on. We recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our parliamentarian. Mr. Perry, have you received any timely requests to address this meeting?
We have no public comment this morning.
Okay. At this point, I'd like to ask Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Richard Mokarski, for news and comments. And Richard, I believe you're in another state right now.
I am. But I apologize for not being there with you. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I want to just briefly expand upon what Chair Wasowitz was talking about and really reflect on the unique position that NIU was in in our research, artistry and innovation. Specifically, I continually am reminded of how innovative we are in including our students in research that is having an impact in the world. And is agile and responsive to the needs of today and tomorrow. So the Fermilab partnership has a curricular component, but you know, at its heart, those students will be getting hands-on research experiences with our faculty, with Fermilab partners, as part of their degree. And that's obviously something we believe strongly in. And when we talked to the previous committee meeting about being attractive to other students from out of state, that is something that I think we do well and we do better than most. And so when we think about quantum, and obviously we've talked about quantum a lot in this committee, obviously the Fermilab partnership is huge, but we also hosted in the last month Quantum Across Illinois, where we had PsiQuantum and Pascal, two companies that are located at the IQMP, come to our campus and engage with both our faculty and students. I don't have the exact number, but I believe we had around 30 folks in our sort of speed dating there. And already out of that, we've had a connection with one of our faculty members sharing a paper that he has IP on, and the internship being promoted from PsiQuantum to our students, because as I heard from the representative from Chicago Quantum Exchange as she left, that was the best one they've done. That's a testament to our faculty, a testament to our students, not only the quantum students and faculty, but we also went to CURE, so kudos to Academic Affairs for putting on such an amazing conference, but we had two students, frankly, blow our minds at the level of research they're doing as an undergraduate. As Aaron from PsiQuantum said, that's the kind of work I was doing in my doctoral dissertation, and these are our undergraduate students. And then finally, I want to say it expands beyond quantum. So I'm in Florida right now to visit one of our partners as they launch a new innovation testing center for me to Toyo. And it was such an affirming trip to hear from our partners at Toyo about how engaged they feel with NIU and how unique they feel our students come to them in internships and eventually in work, and how they want to continue to build that partnership. I say all that to say NIU is special, and the research space is part of what makes us special. So really wish I could be there with you today. Really excited to hear from Dr. Subramani. But with that, I'll turn it back to Chair Wasserwitz.
All right. So thank you for that. And we will move right along here then. By the way, before we started this meeting, Richard, we were talking about SEM 3.0, and Trustee Athus had brought up something that, you know, about things we can brag about. This is something we can brag about. What we're doing from a research perspective is definitely should be getting us bragging rights in a lot of areas. So.
I like his tagline,
that NIU is special. Yeah, there you go. We got the logo going now. Now we got a new tagline. Sport is hard at work.
It sounds like, yeah. Keep talking.
Anyway, with that, we'll go to the state legislative report. Ms. Katie Davidson is here virtually. There you are, Katie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How's everyone?
The stage is yours.
Great, thank you. Good morning, Chair Wasserwitz and members of the board. We are in the final weeks of the spring legislative session with 17 days, give or take, remaining, but who's counting? I will provide a brief update on state relations activities since our February meeting, focusing on the budget, key legislation, and our advocacy efforts. Starting with the budget, as you know, the governor's FY27 proposal includes a 1% increase for public universities. However, that increase is calculated on a base that assumes full distribution of the FY26 appropriations, despite the 2% of those funds not being released. That dynamic continues to create real and compounding pressures for institutions like NIU. In response, we have been consistently engaging legislators and staff to emphasize three points: the very real need for predictable and adequate funding, the impact of inflation on operations, and the value NIU delivers to students, employers, and communities across Illinois. We also launched a coordinated advocacy effort to ensure legislators are hearing directly from the people whose lives and careers are shaped by NIU, not just from the institution itself or me. Turning to the adequate and equitable funding formula, this remains a central long-term priority. We continue to work closely with our peer institutions and advocacy groups and the bill sponsors to advance the proposal. As I've mentioned in past reports, we formally launched the NIU Advocacy Network this year, engaging alumni, faculty, and staff in coordinated outreach. Most recently, the network was activated to support witness slip submissions in the House Higher Education Appropriations Committee, where the equitable funding formula was being heard. That coordinated effort contributed to the bill advancing out of committee, a very important step forward and one that was very much needed to maintain momentum. Our messaging continues to focus on funding tied to student need, the cost of delivering quality education, and protections for all institutions through a hold harmless approach. We are seeing strong support for the formula among legislators and legislative leaders. The primary challenge at this stage remains identifying a dedicated funding source. However, as we often say in Springfield, where there is a will, there is a way, and literally anything can happen. We remain engaged and are not giving up on the possibility of passage this session or during veto session if necessary. This work is critical, particularly for high-impact public universities with strong regional missions like NIU, which play an essential role in serving their regions, supporting workforce development, and meeting the needs of students who rely on access and affordability. On advocacy and engagement, February and March were particularly strong months. We hosted a policy breakfast in Springfield, bringing together legislators, staff, and partners for a focused discussion with NIU's policy research leaders. The event featured experts from Ed Systems, the Illinois P20 Network, the Center for Government Studies, and the Workforce Policy Lab, and demonstrated how NIU's applied nonpartisan expertise supports legislative work in education, workforce development, and local government. That event positioned NIU not just as an advocate, but as a convener and thought partner in higher education policy, and it helped strengthen relationships in a more informal and productive setting. We also hosted NIU Advocacy Day in Springfield, bringing students, alumni, faculty, and staff directly into the legislative process. The event was highly successful and continues to serve as a cornerstone for NIU's advocacy efforts. In addition, NIU leadership participated in our formal appropriations hearings in both the Senate and the House on March 31st and April 9th, respectively. These hearings reinforce our budget priorities, highlight NIU's impact, and engage directly with appropriators at a critical point in the process. Beyond these events, we've maintained steady engagement through meetings in Springfield, as well as ongoing coordination with our public university partners. Briefly on key legislation, we continue to be actively engaged on several issues. This includes ongoing work on proposed campus policy legislation, including academic freedom and campus safety proposals, where we have provided substantive feedback to ensure clarity around institutional authority and alignment with existing legal standards. We also continue to advance a broader effort to reduce administrative burden through modernization of outdated statutory requirements. On capital, we are continuing to advocate for both increased investment in deferred maintenance and improvements to how capital projects are delivered. A key part of that conversation is ensuring that project timelines, state processes, and institutional capacity are better aligned to avoid unnecessary delays and cost escalations. We have consistently elevated this issue, and as a result, we were recently notified that the remaining capital renewal appropriations from the 2018 Rebuild Illinois program will be released. We will continue to advocate for timely execution of those funds, and as discussed in the Academic Affairs Committee, the need for improved facility remains a central talking point in our conversations with legislators. Finally, looking ahead, our focus on the remainder of the session will will be on the FY27 budget, continued movement on the funding formula, and managing late session legislative activities. We will also continue to activate our advocacy network to ensure NIU's impact remains visible throughout the decision-making process. Once again, I'd like to express my gratitude for the swift responses from campus leadership on legislation requiring timely input. I'm especially appreciative of the General Counsel's Office and the Office of Ethics and Compliance. Their contribution on several key bills are directly shaping legislative language that is likely to be reflected in enacted laws. And NIU is increasingly being looked to as a trusted partner for policy expertise. I am happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Katie? So the funding bill looks like it's taken a next step, so I'm taking that as a positive, and then the...
just continues to plug along.
Yeah. And then, but revenues are above expectations, which I was reading
slightly
that the other day. Yeah, well, hey, we'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing. So, all right. I guess there aren't any other questions, Katie, so thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
I will be jumping off. I have to head back over to the Capitol for 11 a.m. meeting, so
okay.
Thank you all for...
Tell them we said hi. Okay, thanks. We'll now move on to agenda item 7B, the Federal Relations Report. Ms. Julia Rowe. Julia, there you are. It's cold
yes.
in D.C. I've been there a lot lately,
yes.
and it is just cold.
We're still waiting for spring.
Yeah.
Yeah, but good morning, everyone. I'll be providing a federal relations update from February to May of this year. Exciting news, yesterday, Congressman Lauren Underwood was on campus to tour the Child Development and Family Center as a part of NIU's FY26 Community Project Funding Award we received through her office. This award will redevelop parts of the center to increase access to childcare on campus and for the DeKalb community. In partnership with RICS and the Graduate School, Federal Relations helps sponsor a graduate student to attend the AAAS Catalyzing Advocacy in Science and Engineering workshop in March, and we met with members of the Illinois Congressional Delegation. Looking at appropriations, on April 3rd, the President released his President's budget request for fiscal year 27. As we've seen in the past requests, the PBR proposed steep reductions to many priority accounts for NIU. This budget requests an overall 3% cut to the Department of Education as the administration continues to try to dismantle the agency and transfer core functions to other agencies. The PBR proposed elimination of SCOG, TRIO, GEARA, GAIN, C-Campus, Title VI, Fulbright-Hays, International and Foreign Language Education Programs. An updated Congressional Budget Office baseline projection released in February showed the Pell Grant program could face an estimated almost $5.5 billion budget shortfall in fiscal year 26, worsening to an $11.5 billion fiscal year 27 shortfall if no action is taken. In the PBR, it did include a $10.5 billion infusion into the Pell Grant program and proposes to keep the grant at current levels for fiscal year 27 to address the shortfall. On the research side, the PBR seeks to have the budgets for a number of graduate fellowships and close out the Social Behavioral Economics Directorate at MSF. It also proposes an almost 50% cut to the National Science Foundation. The House and Senate have begun their markups of the fiscal year 27 appropriations bills. While it rejects the extremely deep cuts proposed in the PBR, the House Commerce Justice Science Subcommittee includes about a 20% cut to MSF over fiscal year 26. Continued advocacy for MSF and key financial aid programs will be a top priority for NIU going forward. The administration has been particularly focused on rulemaking in several areas that impact NIU. Starting with rulemaking in the higher education provisions of H.R. 1, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that passed last summer. On April 30th, the Department of Education published its final rule from the RISE Committee, which addresses federal loan borrowing caps. The list of programs that qualify for the higher professional limits remain the same that was initially proposed, and the caps set for graduate professional programs remain unchanged. This rule goes into effect on July 1 of this year. The department has released a proposed rule on the accountability provisions of HR 1 from the ahead committee. This proposed rule mirrors very closely to what was negotiated in the committee. Based off some updated analysis, MIU have two programs that do not meet the earnings threshold in 2028, which is the first year programs could lose eligibility for Title IV direct loans. It is only for federal loan programs. The Department of Labor has published a notice of proposed rulemaking to revise prevailing wage methodology for employment-based visas. For background, during the first Trump administration, the Department of Labor issued an interim final rule that would have significantly raised the prevailing wage across all four tiers of PERM labor certifications. This increased prevailing wage would make it extremely difficult and expensive for employers like NAU to hire international talent. The Biden administration withdrew the interim rule at the time. On March 26, the White House issued an executive order titled Addressing DEI Discrimination by Federal Contractors, requiring federal agencies to ensure contracts include clauses to prohibit racially discriminatory DEI activities. However, this EO does not explicitly mention grant contracts. And some good news looking at the courts, APLU, AAU, and ACE have been successful in all of their legal challenges of the administration's FMA reimbursement cap cases. The deadline has passed for the administration to ask the Supreme Court for further review of the lower court rulings, and the four lower court rulings stand. A temporary restraining order has been expanded on iPad's admissions data changes. The suit was brought in part by the state of Illinois and provides relief for public universities, including NAU, in new increased data reporting. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, lots going on, Julia. Any questions from the board? Well, you've done a great job. No one has any questions. So thank you on that. And we will move on from here to agenda item 7C, the sponsored program administrative quarterly report put together by Dara Little. And it's in your packet. Does anybody have any questions on that at all? Dennis?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Again, if I'm reading this correctly, it looks like Q3 for FY26 versus Q3 of FY25 is down fairly significantly. I think if we kind of move up on the charts, keep moving up. Is there one more? I'm on the chart that shows award activity by college. Yeah. Yeah. So if you scroll down a couple more to the bottom there. Thank you. Right there. We did 10.7 or 10.8 million in Q3 of last year, 2.2 million this year. Is that just an anomaly of when awards are coming in and it's a timing issue, or why are we down so much? I guess is the question. Yeah. Thank you, Dar.
I'm happy to answer that question. It is not an anomaly. It has to do with the slowing of federal awards. I'm happy to share some data from NSF. They are down. Awards are not going out at the same rate. In fact, they're going out at about a third of what came out last year, which was already down 25% the year before. We are not seeing a rise in rejections. So what that means is we have a lot of things just sitting. Part of that is that the administrative apparatus, with so many federal firings, has slowed to almost a trickle. Specifically NIH, NSF, AHRQ are seeing the largest issues. There are some other timing things as well. Department of Energy, which is our largest federal agency, shifted its priorities in put out the Genesis call, which we were very active in, and those awards have not been made. In fact, it would be this last week, so you know it's very early, but that changed some of what was happening. That being said, we've talked to our colleagues across the country, across the state. This is the story you're hearing from everywhere. We have done quite a bit of work to diversify our funding portfolio. We expect quarter four to see a significant rebound due to industry agreements that are hopefully coming home to roost in quarter four, but it might be quarter one of next year. I don't have any other explanation. We still have the same amount, if not a little bit up, in terms of submissions. Just the awards are not coming.
Can I assume, Richard, that for FY26, as we look at the total picture of what we expect FY26 to be, I mean, it kind of looks like we'll be relatively flat from the state of Illinois standpoint, but down somewhat on a federal standpoint. Is that, do you see that kind of being what the end picture looks like?
I would expect that to be the end picture. I would expect a significant uptick in industry. Again, we have quite a bit that we haven't signed, so we can't talk about, but we have strong signals from several partners. That should not fill those holes. Let's be clear. The fields that are losing funds and not getting funds are not the fields being funded by industry right now. It's a, our friends in humanities and our faculty in foreign languages, those kinds of places are really feeling the pain. Obviously, our Southeast Asia Studies Center lost all of their funding, and you heard from Julia's report. It doesn't seem like they're trying to restore that funding. We do feel very confident in our long-term planning that we should come out of this in the next year or two relatively flat, if not up, because of what we've done on the industry and foundation side. I do want to shout out the collaboration across all the divisions, academic affairs, advancement, OERD. We've done yeoman's work to work with our faculty. We've really stepped up to be able to put ourselves in that position, and 18 months into that, we're expecting, I don't want to put a number on it because I don't want to preempt anything, but we're expecting significant returns on that. We also have some things on the state side that might actually tip the scales for the state to be up this year. Again, there's sort of a, is this going to happen quarter four of this year or quarter one of next year? But we have several large contracts that include research and include service and include pedagogy that are in sort of the late stage negotiations. So I think the sort of bottom line is, yes, we're going to be down in federal. Most of the country is down in federal. We, because federal is not the lion's share of our portfolio, I think we can weather it and position ourselves to be ready on the other side should funding come back. And the fact is, Department of Energy is relatively flat. And we had a very strong submission window for the Genesis funding with double-digit submissions that included partners from FERC, Argonne, University of Chicago, Northwestern, et cetera, et cetera. So we feel good about that. But there's no sugarcoating that federal funding is down. And again, faculty are still producing very quality proposals, meritorious proposals. At this point, they are just sitting.
Okay. Montel?
Thank you.
I think you kind of addressed the question I had, but I was wondering, are we seeing funding down in states like Illinois or other blue states? Is this being spread across the board equitably, or are they picking favorites?
At this point, it seems to be across the board. I don't know if Dara has other, maybe she's in the room or if she has another take on this, but I've talked to colleagues and been on enough webinars that the slow in funding, slowdown in funding seems to be ubiquitous and pretty agnostic to party of the state. But, you know, again, we have a big problem here. But, you know, talking to one of our R1 institutions in the state, they're down 200 million. And so we're feeling like now more than ever, we need to continue to promote the impact of the work, show how it impacts communities, show how it impacts innovation, show how it impacts students, and make sure, and look, our legislature's been great. They want to hear these stories. They are fully in sync with us. We just need to make sure that continues to go well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So, Richard, the from your comments here, it looks like you have a feeling the private industry is kind of filling the gap a little bit here from what we've lost federal-wise?
It's, I would say that it's filling the gap because of our size hole, right? I mean, having a $2 million hole, we can find partners, but I would caution saying that it can't fill the central gap. It's not filling the gap where the gap is being made. And what I mean by that is, when you think of research as a 30-year pipeline, what's really being underfunded right now is, that we rely on the federal government for, is the stuff in that first 10 to 15 years of that pipeline, industry's funding in the last 10, right? The stuff that's ready for market.
Got it.
So it's gonna create cascading effects for society if this continues. And, you know, I think that I do want to celebrate the work that we're doing, the faculty is doing, that industry is doing to step up and support this, these efforts. But I want to caution that we shouldn't say, well, problem solved, because I think what's going to happen is, downstream effects 10, 15 years from now, where we recognize, or I truly believe, that the innovation pipeline in this country was really propelled this country forward is that we've had such an innovative relationship between the federal government funding basic research at universities that then goes to the pipelines. Industry doesn't have to do that from day one. And you know, you think about AI, you think about, I mean, frankly, in our state, you know, YouTube and Netscape, they came out of the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, right? Like, that's a the CRIP project, right? That project was funded by the federal government, it was funded by the state, and yes, then it went out, and it did, which changed the world. We can't predict what the basic research funding that gets cut today is going to not allow us to realize 20 years from now. But it's a really long-winded answer, Eric. I'm sorry, I just feel like it's important to note, yes, we are going to be able to keep a relatively steady cash flow for our research, innovation, and our industry, because industry is stepping up. That's something that we feel like we could capture even if the federal government is continuing to fund. And so what we really hope to do is build the foundation on the industry side, foundation side, state side, so that when the federal government comes back to the table and starts funding the levels, we see it accelerate and we continue to build the base.
All right, thanks. That's a paint of at least a picture that we, I think, all of us can understand. So thank you for that. Are there any other questions? If not, we'll move forward to agenda item 7D. We have a faculty presentation, and we're very fortunate to have the Presidential Research Professor of Management, Mahesh Subramani, with us here today. So Mahesh, you want to hang out back there, or you want to come up here? What do you think?
All right. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today about my research. My family's tired of hearing about it, so I think I can bore other folks with it. So let me begin by going back to turbulent times like these. let's think of April 7th, 2021, as opposed to April 7th, 2026, right? COVID-19 was in full bloom, right? Things were changing all around us, and we really had no understanding of what was happening and why things were happening, right? And we had slides. Do I have a?
Who's advancing slides? Oh, okay. There we go. We're good.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. So nice. I'm going to, okay. So one of the things that was really happening, most of you must have seen this on YouTube and on key news channels, this idea of mistreatment of flight attendants, right? So flight attendants are frontline employees. These are folks who are engaging with customers, passengers specifically in this case, and providing them with great service, right? And what happened during COVID-19 is that they also had this other duty, which was to kind of enforce rules and policies. And we saw headlines like this, right? So as air rage incidents soar and no-fly lists for unruly passengers gain support and so on and so forth, right? You sort of saw those things. You saw pictures of flight attendants being assaulted. Around that time, I was working with, in fact, I'm part of a group called Service Council, 100 plus CFOs, CSOs, CTOs of Fortune 500 companies and others. And I'm the only researcher in that entire group. And among those folks was the VP of in-flight operations for Southwest Airlines. Sonia kind of reached out to me and she sort of said, well, let me ask you two questions and let me see if you can answer those because you seem to do good research. The first question was, how do employees respond to customer mistreatment, right? So what do you do when you are assaulted or when you are, you know, spoken to rudely and or as flight attendants would call it, poked and prodded all the time, right? And second, what skills can we, you know, have them develop in order to manage that customer mistreatment, right? So the story I'm going to be telling you today is within the context of airlines, but it really does apply across various workplace situations and various service situations. So every time there's a conversation between, you know, an employee and a customer, so the kinds of things that I've done sort of applies to those situations as well. So moving along, I'm kind of seeing who's moving the slides, I'm sorry. Okay, next slide. Okay, all right, here. So one of the questions that might come to your mind is, so why me, right? So why should anybody talk to me and say, hey, can you look into this, right? Three key reasons, right? First, I do research that's grounded in business phenomena. So my background is in business. I was a HR manager and organizational effectiveness manager before I became a professor. And so I tend to ask questions that are directly relevant to your lives, right? And my research is mostly in the areas of strategic human resource management, which is kind of a look at the investments that organizations make in employees and how that translates into customer outcomes and financial outcomes. And I also study services, so specifically frontline employees. So that's one reason. The second reason is that I do have a history of industry collaboration. So one of the things that, you know, I've been able to do here at NIU is to direct a small center. It's a Center for Human Capital and Leadership out of the business school. And we have engaged with multiple organizations and we've tried to create connections between faculty, students, and organizations when it comes down to solving specific business problems. And third, I teach in the executive MBA and MBA programs. And so that's the third reason, right? So that's kind of why me. So why am I here at NIU? So that's one of the questions that folks will tend to ask me, right? And there are three key reasons for it and it goes back to our mission. First, you know, our mission of empowering students through educational excellence and experiential learning. So one of the things that I heard you talked about is the idea that when we are trying to bring students in and retain them, what really gets them in and what keeps them is the opportunity to work on real life problems. And I've had the fortune of working with about 12 different student teams and having them work directly with clients, including companies like Caterpillar, on specific business you know, questions and projects. Second, sharing our research and artistry and what I have read there is something which doesn't mean anything to anybody else here. But for folks like me, this is what we worship. Every morning we open our scorecard and see how many times our papers have been cited, right? No one cares. I assure you, no one really cares. But we care because we look at the numbers, because we like numbers, right? So that's what's there right in the center. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to publish a few papers here at NIU. And third, engaging communities for the benefit of the region, state, and nation, and the world. And that's kind of where my true passion lies. So the picture right there represents faculty members, doctoral students, and postdoctoral students from across 7 different countries and 11 different universities. So these are all folks who I have brought together. The total group size is somewhere between 75 to 80. And these are all people who study frontline employees and what can we do to make their lives better, increase their well-being, reduce their stress, and so on and so forth, right? So that's kind of the third way in which I've kind of aligned back to NIU's mission. Next slide, please. Okay. What I'm going to talk about today is solutions-focused research. So typically our research is problem-focused, right? We all begin by saying, what's that one thing somebody studied which, revealed a gap, and then let's go fill that gap. But solutions-focused research says, what are some problems that people are really facing, and what can we do to make a tangible change in their lives, right? And so this project that I'm going to be talking to you about, connected to Southwest Airlines, is really an example of that solutions-focused research. It's just one example. I have many other examples, but we only have about 7 extra minutes now. So this research, in fact, let's advance to the next slide, and then we'll come back here. So next slide. Yeah. So going back to the key questions that were asked to me by Sonia at Southwest Airlines, and let me talk about the solutions that came through it, and then I'll talk about the methodology. The first question was, how do employees respond to customer mistreatment? She called it casual cruelty. And the reason she called it casual cruelty is because this is Southwest Airlines, right? This is a company that's known for the connection between employees and customers. In fact, their ticker symbol is love, L-U-V, right? So the idea is that these are folks who are so good at interacting, so good at connecting with customers. And these folks are being assaulted. These are the folks who have been treated aggressively. And they just sort of look at that and say, why are they doing this? And why are they doing it so casually, right? And so what we found in our research, and I'll talk about who we is in a second, is that there are 4 different response styles that employees have when they're confronted with mistreatment. Call them the 4 R's. The first R is reciprocation. So when they're essentially confronted by aggressive or rude customers, they sort of are aggressive and rude back, right? Second is repair. They try to figure out a way to kind of build a stronger relationship with the customer. They approach the customer and work with them. Third, retreat. They run away, right? Now, you can't run very far in an airplane. I don't know if you guys have noticed this, right? It's very hard to do so. But retreat for them, a lot of times, is just disengagement. Just kind of pulling back and saying, don't want to do this. Don't want to interact with this customer, right? And then finally, recruitment of support, which is kind of finding the right people to help them with the problem, right? So we found that different employees have different propensities to act in these 4 different ways. And that we have to figure out a way to convert those into positive propensities. So retreat is not always bad, right? We all believe we got to go head on and sort of solve the problem. But what we find in this research is that sometimes when you're confronted with a customer who is maybe larger than you, who is ruder than you, right? At that point in time, it's probably better for you to disengage, right? So what we did is we started to look at that research. First, we validated a measure. So we created a measure of these 4 different styles. Then we validated it. We found that depending upon the style that you use, you may have high or low levels of stress and job satisfaction and things of that nature, right? But then we also helped Southwest develop a professional development program for all their flight attendants. So 17,000 different flight attendants went through a 3-module professional development program in which they learned to recognize the signs outside and inside of aggression and aggressiveness, right? And then realizing how to kind of manage it. Part of it is mindfulness, being in the situation, knowing what to do, how to respond, take a deep breath, right? But in other words, it's also about finding allies. So one of the interesting stories that we heard in our research was, when you go into the plane, and as I never knew this, as you're getting into the airplane, the flight attendants are scanning you. And they're saying, John might be a good ally. If I am confronted by a customer who is sort of negative or who's aggressive, maybe I can stand next to John, and maybe John might sort of end up buffering that impact, right? Well, you may. they may be wrong, but that process of scanning is very, very important for them, that process of understanding what's going on, right? So what we did is, during the professional development modules, we taught them those kinds of skills. We also taught them skills that could use to establish a specific tone in the airplane. So when flight attendants are sort of bringing you in, can they create enough cheer so that all of you are sort of in a more positive mood and complain less about things like, you know, constrained spaces, or it's Southwest Airlines, you're not going to get everything, right? So those kinds of things, right? So we created that professional development module. So now, how did we go about doing that? Could we move to the previous slide, please, for a second? We did that using four different data sources. We interviewed 27 flight attendants, base managers, and pilots at Southwest. We used their flight incident reports, so we had access to 17,000 reports that were filed in a period of 2.5 years regarding unruly passengers. We had an employee feedback system, which contains about 23,000-24,000 different reports that employees have regarding mistreatment. And then also we conducted surveys, right? So we surveyed about 7,000 different flight attendants, and out of them we surveyed 2,000 twice. And we used all that data, right, to come up with the outcomes that I just talked about in a second. So could we move forward two slides, please? Perfect. So what were the outcomes? So in terms of the academic outcomes, so first let me talk about the middle part, student research. All this was done, I kept on saying we, right? So who's we? The College of Business does not have a PhD program, but I was able to work with two PhD students from the psychology program to work with me throughout this project. And so together we were able to publish and present up to 12 different papers in multiple conferences, multiple journals, and so on and so forth. It also kind of led those students to complete their thesis and dissertation work, right? So that is the student part of it. In terms of scientific presentations and workshops, we had some major impact because we were presenting at international conferences. And then we also have papers in peer-reviewed journals. Advancing one slide, please. But here's where my heart is. It's the mentoring and the collaborations. This is kind of who I am, ultimately, right? We were talking about differentiation. This is what makes me go, right? On the left, we have the students, right? So we have Nick Smith and Judy Hu, both of them who are now PhDs and who are still I'm going to see Nick and his family tomorrow. They're going to come for his graduation. There are going to be 7 people who are going to come all the way from Houston. And I'm going to sit and eat with them, right? So that's the first part, right? The mentoring part. The second part is those are my Southwest peeps, right? So those are the flight attendants and base managers at Southwest Airlines who I worked with and who I still kept in touch with. In fact, one of them just had a baby, and I just sent them a text earlier this morning congratulating them, right? So that's the second part. And third, my connections with Service Council, this group that is growing. When we started Service Council, we only had 50 companies. Today, we have 120 different companies in it. And that is a great connection for me, not just to kind of learn from them, but also for them to learn from me, you know, sort of kind of building a bridge. So that's kind of the Southwest story. So what am I up to? What am I working on now? So that's the next slide and the last slide, essentially. Current projects. So these are projects that might appeal to some of you for sure, those of you who work with startups, right? So I'm looking at human resource management practices in startups and scale-ups. So as companies grow, you know, what happens to the HR function? Do you grow the HR function exponentially too, as companies grow exponentially? Or do you sort of go through a process of increasing and decreasing the size of the HR function? So that's one project. I'm looking at why do customers resist service policies? So when we ask customers to do something, why is it that they push back? And we are trying to study the psychological mechanisms of that using lab studies as well as using large data. One of the questions that I'm also working on is looking at gig workers. in India specifically, and how they are influenced by algorithms. So these are gig workers who are asked to be in one specific place and charge a specific fee and so on and so forth. If they don't do it, they could be shut out of the system, right? And we're trying to study their lives and how do they push back against that system. And finally, one of the questions that I'm asking is human resource management, given the fact that we have so much of AI and technology within organizations, is the next frontier for human resource management customer management? So should we, the way we sort of recruit and select and train and appraise and reward employees, should we be doing the same with customers? Can we use the same principles there? So that's something which I'm exploring with a series of projects with folks around the world. So those are the current projects, and that's all I've got. Thank you.
Any questions?
We have a family member who is a flight attendant, not for Southwest, but what you mentioned in terms of during the boarding process.
Yep.
It's exactly what she does. She stands at the front and she kind of identifies certain passengers that she either thinks might be a problem because of how they're boarding, yes, or somebody that she can use as an ally.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, what you mentioned is absolutely what they're doing. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what is Southwest going to do with all this data?
So the professional development program, like I mentioned, so they rolled that out to all their employees. We did an evaluation of those programs, and one of the things that we noticed is that they learned, the flight attendants learned something, but they also felt more positively about the company itself, the fact that the company was investing in them, right? One of the things that Southwest does, and this is the strangest thing that I found, was that Southwest, you would expect customer service to be one of its key competency, and therefore a lot of training would be around customer service. Their employees go through a 2-week training period when they come in, right, orientation period, and not even 1 hour is dedicated to customer service training. Because their focus is completely on hiring for attitude and training for skills, right? So their idea is that you come in into the flight. So who's training, right? Who's doing the training? They train each other. So when you come into the airplane, what ends up happening is that you learn from, they always try to pair people who are more experienced and people who are less experienced. So the people who are less experienced are learning more from the folks who are more experienced, right? So this was a little insight that we took. And what Southwest is now doing is they're rolling out a mentoring program, a formal mentoring program for their flight attendants. What they've done is they've identified a set of flight attendants who are now pretty advanced in their career. And when I say advanced in their careers, we actually have, in my data set, I have 15 flight attendants who are above the age of 80, right? So what they're doing is that they're trying to find a way for these flight attendants to start mentoring the new ones who are coming in, who are not imbibed in the Southwest way. So that's one of the implications, right? The measure that we created, it's a 21 item survey measure, which has been validated. Southwest Airlines is using that and is considering using that during the orientation session as well to kind of find out, what styles do you really belong to and how can you sort of use that style in managing mistreatment.
So how many students touch this project with you?
Two core students, these were the two PhD students, and then on top of it, three other PhD students who helped with some focus groups and so on and so forth.
Okay.
So I would say about five in total,
yeah.
Out of which, like I said, two of those students ended up using the data for their master's thesis as well, and publications and so on and so forth.
Because, when we talked a little bit before, Trustee Athos, talked about bragging a little bit more about the university. Yeah. This is the type of thing that we need to brag about, because A, you're working with a brand name that,
yep,
has a fairly good reputation, mm-hmm, throughout. Some folks don't like it, but, I think in general, we all tend to use Southwest at some point in our life. And
you fly private all the time, you don't care.
Yeah. And it's a great project, and it's a great thing for us to talk about.
Thank you.
Good job.
I want to say, Professor, first of all, thank you for the information and for making me feel like I'm back in the lecture hall. I like your style of presentation. You know, this is, to me, this is a case of human behavior change. And I think you're right. I mean, we are in the midst of a period of significant change in human nature, driven by multiple factors. I mean, and specific to the airlines, I saw a discussion the other day about how now they're talking about airports limiting sales of alcohol prior to flights to address issues of unruly passengers. But I think about the evolution, too, of the human nature, and I'll turn to myself. I mean, for, I don't know, 20, 25 years, we've received those robocalls or solicitations by phone, and I used to be pretty polite about it, you know, say, oh, no, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. You know, now it's like, bam, you know, and it's just it's the evolution of how we are cultured and addressed. And we've headed a long ways down this path. I would assume this type of element and research will only continue to grow. I think part to your comment, Dennis, that in the College of Business in management, this is a big piece for students to have to adapt to.
It's huge. It's huge. And one of the questions that Trustee Eric had asked the question regarding, AI, and you had sort of brought in that AI question as well with your, eighth grade granddaughter. I think when we think of differentiating ourselves from others, when it comes down to university or for that matter programs, we have to start thinking about AI as basically table stakes. Yeah. Everybody's doing that, right? Everybody's learning AI, everybody's sort of incorporating that into curriculum. But I think this part that you talked about, the humanity, and I'm biased, I gotta tell you, because that's my thing, right? The humanity piece is the differentiator. If we can get our students to think more about being empathetic, putting themselves in the shoes of the other, you know, having the right kinds of interpersonal skills and interacting with the right people, right? Building networks, building connections, but not in a transactional kind of way, like I did this for you, you know, what can you do for me today sort of a thing, but in the long run. I mean, these are the kinds of human skills that will really help us differentiate ourselves. And you know what? We have significant capability in that direction. I'm looking at it from the College of Business perspective, and I gotta tell you, our students are incredible. I think we have at least two folks here who have taught them, and they know what I'm talking about. They might not have the greatest grades in the world when they came in, but my God, in terms of humanity and civility and the ability to work really hard, we have that. I think what we have to do is figure out a way to take that and make that a competitive advantage. I think that's basically where my mind is on this one.
Montel?
In terms of how you go about the studies themselves,
yes.
Are you being sponsored by a Southwest? Do they pay for resources? Or at the end of the day, is this a marketable type of activity?
So I'm going to answer that in two parts. I think the first part is, can this be marketable? And the answer is absolutely yes, right? If a consultant would have worked with them, they would have charged them hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? Without any of the other outcomes, like student outcomes or faculty research outcomes or any of that sort. In terms of the actual project in that particular case, their support was in terms of giving us the data, in giving us flight tickets. So essentially, every time we flew to Dallas or talked to flight attendants, they kind of paid for that. But they did not have a budget dedicated to this project. I moved on regardless for a simple reason. It was COVID time, 2021. And I knew that whatever we did today would have a positive impact. If it changed the life of one flight attendant, it was completely worth it for me. And that's the reason I didn't even go through the process of, you know, let's write a contract and get some money and things of that nature. Ideally, we would do all of those things as well. So I talked about the Center for Human Capital. So what we, you know, do or did was we would develop a contract, and then we would sort of speak with the client and then sort of revise it, come up with the right numbers, and so on and so forth. But this was one of the situations where I felt, gotta move, can't wait. And they said, we'll keep the data tap flowing. You know, just come and take it, but give us something that we can apply tomorrow, which we were able to.
Anyone else? I had a question here. First of all, I love that you came up here and spoke to us in this way instead of behind the microphone over there. So this is I've been on the board now, you know, 8-9 years, and this is the first time that at least I can recollect that that's happened. So thank you for doing that. In your current projects, have you ever dealt with PEOs at all, preferred employer option, outsourced HR?
Not directly, no.
Okay. No. Yeah, but just I happened to be in a meeting with one yesterday as you're saying this. Yeah. I'm thinking, wow, that would be something good to look at, because it's companies, you know, basically 10 to 100 employees.
Correct.
Where they outsource that. Do you ever work with other professors like List or Taylor or over in Chicago? Or?
I work with folks mostly in Europe and Australia, interestingly. I have only one partner in crime in the United States. So that's the other interesting thing, right? So when we talk about the NIU brand is not restricted to Northern Illinois. Yeah. There are people across the world who kind of know of NIU, not just through me, but through... When you look at the folks who were selected for presidential research professors, I was fortunate enough to kind of be part of that process of selection. And I was looking at those people and their sponsors, people who came in and talked about them, almost every single time, these were folks from other countries and other universities. Our impact is much bigger and much broader than we think it is, and much broader than our students think it is, right? So I think that the brand is not an NIU, Northern Illinois brand. It's an NIU brand, which is much bigger.
Yes.
As Dr. Freeman said, you know, the Husky part. It's the Husky part which sort of just cuts across borders.
Yeah, I think it's into the bragging part we were talking about. So I know we're probably taking notes back there on how we're going to brag about this. So any other questions? All right.
Thank you for the
With that, thank you very much. For that. Are there any other matters requiring the attention of the board today? Dennis, did you're good? Okay. All right. Our next meeting date, the next meeting of the Research and Innovation, Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee is, August 28, 2026. May I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So made, Strzok.
Second, Barsema.
We have a motion and we have a second. Mrs. Wright, will you please call the roll call for the vote to adjourn the meeting?
Committee Vice Chair Rita Athus?
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Barsema?
Yes.
Trustee John Butler?
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero? Trustee James Innes?
Yes.
Trustee Leland Strom?
Yes.
Committee Chair Eric Wasowitz?
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Yes.
Thank you.
So this meeting is now adjourned. This concludes the Research and Innovation, Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee meeting. And we will start.
Let's come back at 11:35.
11:35.
About 5 minutes.
We're adjourned.